Well, man, it's good to be back out here. I came through this program. I entered here March 20th, and I got out on June 17th, and I came down with me and Chris and Preston went on a little fishing trip this past weekend, and they asked me to come out here and speak to you guys, man. I kind of jumped on the opportunity because this is where I found God out here, man. Like, I got here and just stuff started to happen I couldn't explain. And what I'm about to do, man, I'm not here to preach at you, tell you to do this, tell you to do that. I'm just going to kind of tell you about my testimony and what God did in my life and where I'm at today, and like what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now. And, my name's Kirk Savoy. For those of y'all that don't know, I'm from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I'm going to kind of start in my childhood, man, because I'm not that old, and it's part of my story. And I was born on March 13th, 1989, in Lake Charles, Louisiana. I got a brother. Mom and dad, basic run-of-the-mill family, man. There was nothing, absolutely nothing in my childhood that would lead you to believe that I was going to go down the road that I went down. I had a very normal family, all families are normal from the outside. We had our issues internally inside the family, but nothing that would have altered the path that I went down. And I'm kind of going to... trying to tell you what it looked like internally and externally going through high school, man. I was always had this dream when I was a child that I was going to play professional baseball, man. And, I was always excelled at sports. It was something that I got into when I was young, from T-ball all the way through, till my drug addiction took over. I always excelled at it. There wasn't a whole lot of things I had to do to be good at it. It was a God-given ability that I took for granted at the time. And it ended up slipping away from me. That happens to us when we take things for granted. And went through high school, man, and I guess I was your average class fuck up. I didn't go to school. I didn't do the things I needed to do while I was there. Just a class clown, man. I really didn't go to school my junior and senior year, really. You think of it, I was doing it, man. I got involved with drugs probably about my junior and senior year of high school, man, because, there was, this bubble, man, and I never really... Here's this bubble over here, and I was standing outside of it, man. I could fit in with any crowd you wanted to fit in with, the jocks, the nerds, all these people, man. I always got along with everybody, man, but deep down inside, I never really felt like I fit in with a crowd. And, there was always this group, man, and they were the ones going out partying, having sex, just looked like they were having a good time, man. And, that's what I wanted. I wanted to be a normal high school kid, and that's what I thought that looked like. So, I kind of gravitated towards that crowd, and through this time, I'll tell you a little bit, and this isn't to brag or boast. This is just to tell you where I'm at. My junior year of high school, man, I was winning awards all throughout high school, football and baseball, man. I can honestly say I was a very good athlete. I had All-State honors. I was runner-up for Mr. Louisiana baseball my senior year. I was throwing an average of 90 to 94 miles an hour. I got defensive MVP for football, had all district, all state honors, two sports scholarships. Could have went to any SEC school in the nation when I graduated high school. There was just that little void inside of me, man. I didn't know what it was, and it was filled. I'll tell you this, I got away with a lot of things in high school that, I don't blame it on the high school I went to. It was just sports, it's kind of like an understood thing sometimes. Like, sports will carry you through school, man. If you're a good athlete, they want to see you succeed, move on, and this and that. And I got away with a lot of things I shouldn't have got away with. I'm not going to say they did me a disservice because ultimately it came back on me. But a lot of people, I think, knew about my drug addiction. But because of my performance on the field, it kind of overshadowed it. It's like that reputation it talks about in the book, we have this reputation, but deep down inside, we know we don't deserve it. I'm reading these articles on Saturday mornings, and I'm like, man, just if these people really knew, if they had any freaking clue what was going on, I wouldn't be getting the recognition that I'm getting, man. I shouldn't even be where I'm at. It was just something, like I said, it came natural to me. I did not have to put in the work it took to be good at that baseball and football. And coming out of high school, man, I guess it was my junior and senior year, man. I started smoking weed. I started smoking weed as a sophomore, but it was just very, very recreational, man. I wasn't even at a pothead stage yet. It was just I'd smoke on the weekend, maybe once or twice a month. That gradually started progressing. I guess it had been my junior year. It was a relationship I got involved in, man. And she was a little bit older than I was, and with that older crowd came a little bit more life experience for me. And, you know, they were farther along and experiencing things that I don't think I was ready for at that point in time. You know, going out as a 15, 16-year-old to all these clubs and stuff and getting into ecstasy and cocaine and you name it, Xanax. And, you know, I was having a good time, man. It was a party then. I can honestly say some of the best times I've ever had were on drugs and alcohol, man. I had a badass time. And I got involved with that crowd, man, and it just, you know, I could tell from get-go that I was a little bit different than they were, man, because when everybody else was stopping, I was still going. You know, I was that guy, you know, the bar closed down, I was ready to go close the after-hours bar down, fighting, you know, having sex, doing, you know, that's just the stuff I thought that was cool, man. And I guess at that point in time, it spiraled down to where there's a guy that I got introduced to, and I got introduced to OxyContin. It was probably my senior year, going into my senior year. And at that point in time, man, I got that sense of ease and comfort the book talks about. You know, I'd been searching for a while for it, and I finally found it. And from day one, man, I can honestly say I was addicted. I didn't see that at the time. I always thought it was just this, you know, if I can only get past the physical part. You know, like I wanted to quit real early. Like, drugs and alcohol brought me to my knees. Actually, it was the dope that brought me to my knees real quick. And, I'm kind of going to jump back and forth here, guys, so kind of stay with me. It's, you know, it's tough. There's a lot to pack into an hour. And, I guess I graduated, I got addicted to OxyContin my junior and senior year, slowly developed and started off snorting them, eating them. And, I guess we were detoxing one day, and I only had $12 in my wallet, and the guy that I was with, he was 28 years old, you know, had been through the military, had a discharge for, you know, he got caught with heroin in the military, he was shooting up at the time, and we decided we were going to split a pill, you know, and I knew it was just a 40 milligram OxyContin, and I knew that wasn't going to be enough to keep me from getting sick, and at that point, he offered, you know, he's like, man, I got some extra needles, they're clean, you want me to shoot you up, you know, you have a lot better chance of staying, you know, at least feeling right for a little bit. So I jumped on it, man. I decided to do it, and he shot me up, man. And I remember the first thought that went through my mind was, like, I've been wasting these things for almost a year now. You know, I've been wasting my money. This is the way to do it. From that point on, man, I never snorted another pill besides the Xanax again, man. I got addicted to the whole process of shooting up. You know, it was just like a whole nother addiction with the addiction. And that continued, man, from my junior year all the way through my senior year. So like I said, all the awards and stuff I was winning, you got to remember, man, I'm killing myself at this point in time. I'm sticking a needle in my arm, and there's no explanation for how I'm able to perform at that point in time. To have the opportunity to go to an LSU or an Arkansas, an Ole Miss, an Alabama, or Northwestern State, you know, those were the offers I was getting out of high school. And because I didn't take care of what I needed to take care of in the classroom, I became an academic casualty. I signed with Northwestern State because they were the only ones that would still have some money on the table for me to go to school. All the other big schools, they like to get their money out quick so they can get their recruiting class lined out. And they would hold back preferred walk-ons for me. But I actually signed to signed with Northwestern State for leverage in the draft, in the MLB draft that year. I mean, I had a bunch of scouts starting to find me late in my senior year, and Colorado Rockies had met with me and my dad at the Class A, B, and C state championships, and they were offering me a preliminary draft pick at 32. It's going to be in the 32nd round. It's like $25,000 to $35,000, which, guys, that's really not a whole lot of money in the minors, man. You got to get your money up front because, really, you're getting that signing bonus, and then you go on, and you're like, you're living off of meal money, basically, you know, and it just wasn't enough. And I felt like if I went to junior college, I could get drafted for more the next year, and you know, I could get my shit together during that point in time. And it didn't fit in right, so I decided to go to LSU Eunice. And just give you a little background on them, man. They've had 42 players drafted out of the past 7 years. They've won 4 national titles, including the one we just won this year. Just the best place I could think to go, man, to move to the level that I wanted to go to. So it was that summer I graduated, and you know, I knew I needed to quit at this point in time. I didn't want to do drugs. My dream is right here at my fingertips, a childhood dream that I something I wanted to do for the rest of my life, man, and make a living doing. And I actually had that opportunity, and I knew I needed to quit. So I started, you know, if only I could get away from these people. You know, that's going to fix it. I just need to get away from these people. I'll get some separation. So I moved to Lake Charles. My grandpa owned a construction company in Lake Charles. Moved down there with him probably about 2 weeks. And I was driving back and forth every day, guys. Like, that's when I finally realized, man, like, this thing's got a grip on me. You know, I'm trying to separate myself from it, and it keeps pulling me back. You know, and at this point in time, you know, it talks about it in Bill's story. It ceased to be a luxury and started becoming a necessity. I'd already crossed that threshold at that point in time where I didn't have a choice whether I drank or drugged again, but I didn't know it. You know, I didn't know it yet, and I still thought I had a little willpower. Didn't have a solution at the time either, and that void was still there. And, you know, I just wasn't comfortable with myself without drugs and alcohol, man. So that was really what was driving me back every day. And finally, I was like, I'm spending more money down here in Lake Charles. This isn't working out. You know, I need to move back. You know, I'm going to end up in a bigger hole down here than I need to be in. I'll move back, and then, you know, I'll try whatever I can while I'm living in Alexandria, and maybe it'll work out. And surely when I get to Eunice and playing baseball and around a bunch of guys that are sober and playing ball, I'll be able to do it. Well, the time, I mean, it got there quick. I moved down there in August of that, I guess it had been 2007. And, I remember my ride down there. I went and I signed with him. I was high on 2 or 3 80s at that point in time when I signed my letter of intent. I moved down there and, man, I just, miserable. Absolutely miserable, man. I didn't want to be there. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be. You know, the guy, it was a tough program. And they had, like I said, they had 42 draft picks in the past 5 or 6 years. So you know the level of talent that's there. And I was going to have to do something to actually separate myself from the guys that were there at that point in time. And I didn't have the want to or the drive to do it, man. Drugs were my priority at that point in time, and I just did not have the willpower to do what it took to move on to the next level. And there were some events that started to happen while I was there, man, and I saw the roof caving in on top of me. Like, I knew I wasn't going to be able to get away with what I was doing for much longer before I got caught, and I didn't want to get blackballed from the NCAA because I wanted to go back and play in case it happened. So I remember we were doing grade checks. It was the day before we did grade checks, and I hadn't been going to class. I drove back and forth from Alexandria to Eunice, which is an hour and a half drive every single day. Every single day, and I always went back to get that last pill. It was always the last pill I was going to get. In my mind, that was my firm resolution. This is going to be the last one. And I get back to Eunice, and I start detoxing, and that resolve's gone. You know, it talks about that in Bill's story also, man. You know, the resolve, that firm resolution I had, and it's in the doctor's opinion, that vicious cycle was out the window, man. I couldn't even call it to mind, and find myself right back down there getting another pill. Did that for probably a month, man. I couldn't take it anymore. Girlfriend had broke up with me at that point in time. There were some circumstances that were, I guess they got me willing to do something different, but I still had some ideas. I just wanted to get out of the situation I was in and get a fresh start and you know, try life without baseball for a little bit. You know, I've been wrapped up in organized sports for my whole life at this point in time, and I wanted to be a normal kid, you know, with the bong as a centerpiece on my coffee table. Just, that's what I thought was normal. I mean, you know, just go have a good time. Just get rid of Oxycontin. I'm going to be good. I went down there and, you know, they pointed me towards the 12 steps, but it's like your average treatment center. You know, they told me how much money I spent on this, you know, insurance this, and it does this to your brain. Well, I really don't give a fuck. At this point, I don't give a fuck what it does to my brain. I don't care how much money I spent on it. Just tell me how to stop. And, I guess I wasn't willing to do what they told me to do. You know, they took us through our first 3 steps. I didn't have a grasp on it. I don't think I cracked the book once. I just filled out my packets, turned them in, and just trying to get out of there, get a token so I can get back on the life. You know, I still had all these lurking notions that I was going to be able to do it my way. Well, didn't work out like that. Got out, stayed clean 2 weeks, started drinking again. Smoking. I probably started drinking and smoking the same night. It was an LSU Louisiana Tech football game, and you know, that was, dude, it wasn't 2 or 3 weeks, and I was back with a needle in my arm, shooting up 80 to 160 milligrams a day, which is just as bad, if not a little bit worse, than what I was doing when I went in there. You know, like I said, I just wasn't comfortable. I remember getting out and just having this uneasy feeling. We had to pull over 2 or 3 times on the way back to Alexandria because I was nervous, man. I just did not feel right about anything. You know, I didn't have a solution to the problem that I was dealing with. Didn't even have a clue what the problem was. I just knew if I didn't have drugs and alcohol, man, I wasn't functioning the way I thought I should. And got back, and I remember I was watching Intervention. It was these these two gay guys were shooting up meth, and that's when I was just like, fuck it, you know, I'm going to get me a pill. So I called up my buddy, same guy that shot me up for the first time. He went and got me a pill, and I was back off to the races again. And, you know, I thought it was bad the first time I went into treatment, but my life, drugs and alcohol, the next 5 years took me to places I couldn't even imagine. You know, I formed that gangster mentality, or what I thought was a gangster mentality. I thought I was just some thug, and I was going to run the streets and be a hustler and this and that. And it didn't work out like that, man. You know, I wasn't raised to do those kind of things. Really didn't want to do those kind of things, man, but it was an easy way to get pills and to be able to function the way I needed to function. And, man, through that 5 years, I'd been kicked out of both my mom and my dad's house multiple times. And finally, my dad, you know, he wrote out a contract with me that last time I went to when I went to KJ and Addiction Center. And, you know, he was pretty firm and stiff on his contract. You know, if I were to break it, like, that was going to be it. He was going to cut all ties. He was going to turn me over to God. No, you know, no contact whatsoever. And I remember he had let me move back in under the stipulation. I would pass drug tests every week. You know, I'd give him my paycheck. And, you know, we're dope fiends, man. We're alcoholics. We find ways to get around all that, man. We're going to find a way to get what we need to live. You know, it's like taking that next breath. You know, we needed to live. And I was going to find a way, and I sure did, man. And he found some needles and spoons in my truck one day while I was gone with a buddy to cop some dope. And got back home, and I could just see the look in his eye. And I was said, Kirk, I need to talk. Sat down, and, you know, he was sitting there bawling, crying, probably the hardest thing he ever had to do in his life, man. I can't imagine. I don't have kids, but, you know, he had to turn me over to God's hands, you know. And I hugged him around the neck, and I told him, Dad, that's what needs to happen. You know, it needs to happen. I'm not getting any better living here. You know, maybe I need to just... It was a sink or swim point in time in my life. You know, you're going to go out there on your own, you're going to sink or you're going to swim. And he gave me a week to find a place to live. And there was a buddy of mine that... his dad had died when we were senior in high school, and called him up and, you know, kind of explained the situation. His widowed mom was living out there with just him and his two little sisters. They had an extra bedroom. I decided I was going to go live out there with them just temporarily. And I was always in my mind, I had this master plan every time I did something. And I'd get my shit together, have enough money, put a down payment on an apartment, and I'd find a place to live, work, do that kind of thing. And man, I just never... Nothing ever worked out the way I saw it and I envisioned it. And I got over there and ended up staying a year. And in that year, man, I just, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures. And like I said, this would be my best man in my wedding still today. And, you know, it's the ones that are closest to us are the easiest ones to hurt. And his dad died when we were seniors in high school. They had a great relationship, man. They had a camp out at Catahoula Lake, and they were always out there hunting, fishing. And during that period of time, man, like, I would go in there, and they had a safe in the closet, and these guys had unbelievable amount of guns, like unbelievable amount, hundreds to probably 100 to 200 guns, you know, badass guns in their gun safe, you know, anywhere ranging from $2,000 to $10,000. And I'd go in there with the intentions, you know, I'm just going to get this one, I'll go hawk it, and I'll pay it back with my next paycheck, get it out, you know, I just need it for now just so I don't get sick during the week. And man, by the time that was said and done, and I had the best of intentions when I did it, I was going to get it the next week in my mind. And, I went and I got up to about 15, 16 guns that I had hawked out at that point in time. It was just stacking up. I knew I needed to get out of there and get a fresh start. And before I got caught, pretty much, I was afraid I was about to get caught. So I moved out, and I actually talked my mom into letting me move to Baton Rouge with her. And she agreed. You know, mom has a soft spot. She was always easier to push over than my dad was. And, she let me move in there under the stipulation, no drugs in the house, blah, blah, blah. You know, you're going to be clean. You're going to pay a couple of bills here and there. And, well, I got down there and I decided I was going to go back to school at a community college. I'd actually went through a detox. I got myself clean for 2 weeks, exactly 2 weeks. And I was drawing unemployment because the reason I moved out of the house, I got fired from Glass Specialty because I ran into the back of a company vehicle with a forklift. I had passed out on dope and ran in the back of a company vehicle. There were some other things that took place while I was there that kind of, you know, I should have been fired a long time ago, but it was a close family friend. And he called me in there and he said, you know, man, we're doing you a disservice by giving you a paycheck here. And, man, I left there bawling ass crying. That's when I called my mom, put her on a guilt trip, and I moved in down there. Drawing unemployment, and I decided I wanted to go back to school at Baton Rouge Community College. Had myself detoxed. I was clean. And I remember I was going to pay my my tuition at the registrar's office. And I was sitting in line, I was waiting, you know. I'm feeling good about myself, I'm feeling good about this. I'm about to go back to school and get my life together, you know. And I actually went through the detox, and I felt real, real confident this time that life was going to look different. And this guy was sitting there staring at me in the line. He was paying his bill, and he was waiting for the lady to do something. He's turning around, he's looking at me, and I'm like, and I'm kind of thinking, you know, it's kind of weird. I mean, he's just sitting there staring at me. We're having like a mug contest, and he walks up to me when he gets done. And he's like, "Hey man, you don't do Oxycontin, do you?" I was like, "Are you a cop, man? Really?" Like, he's like, "Nah, dude, I saw the scars on your arms." And I was like, "Oh my God." So I walked off and I started talking to him. When we talked prices and if he had any now. And sure enough, he had a couple in his truck. And like I said, man, I wasn't armed with any facts. I wasn't armed with a solution. And I was back off to the races again. That went on for another year and a half. It brought me to places I never thought I'd imagine, man. I was down in South Baton Rouge, I walked into a little dope house, man. I walked into a trap house and caught a box cutter across the face. You know, there's just several times I can look at my life where I shouldn't be here, man. And looking back from it and the perspective I have today, I can see God's fingerprints all over the scene. So that went on, man, and I just, you know, my mom finally kicked me out of the house. I jumped around from apartment to apartment, just burning up any bridge I could, basically. You know, I was desperate at this point in time. I was moving all around Baton Rouge, just trying to keep my head above water. I had a job. I was making plenty of money to be able to pay bills and afford a place to live and all that good stuff. And I actually had a good hookup in California where we were flying in a bunch of bug, probably about 3-4 pounds every 2 weeks. You know, I was making good money off of that, man. I should have been able to function, man. And that's kind of when I realized, you know, there's not enough money in the world that's going to fix what I got. You know, I go broke every single time I get a good lick. When it's time to re-up, I don't have my money, and it's just miserable. It always seemed like I was broke, you know, and then there's no reason for it. And finally, I got to that miserable state, man, where I was just sitting in that bitter morass of self-pity. Didn't want to live anymore, didn't want to die, but it just, you know, I'd thrown away my childhood dream, you know, at the time I thought I did, and I was just sitting there in self-pity for myself, man, wanting to point fingers at everybody else. My mom did this, my dad did this, you know, this girl did this. I can't tell you how many times I shot dope over a female, you know, it's ridiculous. And finally, I decided I was going to take my life into my own hands. And I drove out, it was probably about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I had been staying with a buddy, and it was horrible, man. We had been getting into it almost physically, you know. And I drove out to River Road, and I put a pistol in my mouth, man. And at some point in time, like, if you'd hooked a lie detector test up to me on the way out there, man, I was going to kill myself. There was no doubt in my mind I was going to do it. And when I got out there, you can basically say I chickened out, man. Just like this voice in my head told me dying was the easy way out. And I decided that I was going to call my dad and talk to him about what was going on, see if we couldn't work something out where I could get back into a Suboxone program. Because I'd tried some IOPs and some other stuff in between here, man, because I'm trying to find a way out these past 5 years. You know, probably three years. And I just didn't have one, man. And I was burning up every good idea I had, and I was running out of options. And, you know, I got honest with him about a couple of stuff. I minimized the hell out of him. I told him it was only Xanax, and, you know, I'd take Suboxone every once in a while, but that was all I was doing, smoking a little bud. And even then, he said, "Man, Kirk, I can't help you. You know, I'm not going to be able to do it. You know, if you really want to quit, I will fund one more treatment center for you, and that is it." So I sat on that I got off the phone with him, and I broke down crying at the job site, and I was just, you know, I was a mess, and I sat on that for about a week, man. I was like, man, I tried rehabs. I got in there, and I did what they told me to do. I graduated, I got the coin and everything, but it didn't work. You know, I don't want to go to another one. I don't want to go waste 3 months that I could be shooting dope. And got in there, man, and I can tell you on March 20th of that year, man, something bigger than myself intervened in my life. And it was actually, I wasn't even supposed to come to Mark Houston. I was supposed to go to some place in Arizona. But because of the cash and insurance situation, it just ended up that I walked outside to make some phone calls. You know, you got to get that last hurrah before you go to rehab. And I was in Lafayette, and I walked outside. I was lining up all my dope because I knew I was getting ready to go, and I was trying to wheeze my way off. And you know, they had found this place, and I was supposed to drive to Lafayette to meet my dad, living in Baton Rouge, about a 45-minute drive. It took me 8 hours to get there. You know, I'd stopped off and got me an 8-ball of Coke. I'd had 30 rocks of cotton, 2 Xanax, an eighth of weed, and, you know, I had a couple of subs just in case I ran out. And sure enough, by the time we hit Beaumont, I was out of dope. You know, and that's only a 3-hour drive. I had a couple of buddies calling me, making sure I was still alive. You know, I was in a bad spot when I left Baton Rouge that day, and but I was actually supposed to go to someplace in Arizona, and they ended up, when I came back in, they're like, you're going to go to Mark Houston Recovery, and whatever, just get me somewhere. And met my dad, when we had a 3-day trip out of it. When I pulled in the gate, man, not to say, Stephen was one of the first people I saw. He walked into the office, and I saw him, and Stephen's kind of an intimidating guy. When you look at him, he's got the tats all over him. I was like, man, fuck this place. You know, I don't like it already, but something, it was just, I was ready to be done at that point in time, guys. It talks about being beaten into a state of reasonableness. And, like, it took a lot of, I had to lose absolutely everything. The only reason I still had a truck to sleep in was because my dad was holding on to the title. He wouldn't give me the title of my truck. And I actually didn't lose anything. I voluntarily gave it up. Anything I ever lost, I know exactly where it's at. You know, I got here and I saw him and there was a couple other guys, man, they had this look in their eyes. And it was something, you know, and Bill talks about it too when Eddie was sitting across the table from him. You know, he saw a guy that was armed with the facts about himself. He was lit on fire about something. It wasn't dope and alcohol that was doing it. And it was something that I wanted at that point in time. I was willing to do whatever it took to get there. And, you know, I was real, real hesitant on another 12-step program. You know, I thought I had done the steps before, reading them off the wall, and I had met with sponsors, I had been to meetings, I had done all that good stuff, and, you know, that shit doesn't work. You know, there's a bunch of fucking sob stories going around the meeting, but, you know, I was in a watered-down solution. It was a bunch of middle-of-the-road meetings I was sitting in, and I did that for 6 years, man, and I never, maybe I heard one, and my ears just weren't open to it, but when I got here, I heard the solution, man, that had some depth and weight, and I saw the look in some guys' eyes, and they were on fire about this thing, and I started doing what they told me to do, and I guess I struggled with it for about a month. You know, I was not struggling with the fact that I didn't want to do it, but I wanted to force an experience so bad that it wasn't happening. I was setting expectations up on certain steps, and I wasn't getting the actual message. If that makes any sense to you guys, I was trying to overcomplicate the shit out of this thing. You know, where's it at? You know, where's this burning bush? You know, when's it going to happen? And I was setting, in a way, I was setting expectations up on God, man. I was setting myself up to fail, you know. And I remember my program director said, you need to slow down, because I was rushing through all my work. He's like, you need to slow down, you're going to miss it. He's like, you're going to miss it. And I did, man. And finally, it was about a month and a half into it, and the light started to come on, man. I started thinking about it, and I was like, man, something that has obsessed my life for 5 years, I haven't had one thought about it since I got here. You know, I went through my detox here, and that was the last time I thought about drugs. And I actually bit the pillow while I was in here, because my dad had written a $4,000 check for me to go to a detox, but they were kind of, I mean, I didn't want to spend any more of my dad's money. We're not a rich family, man. You know, my dad went to a mutual fund to pay for this place, and, you know, I'm forever in debt to him for that, you know, and just, guys, just from one little seed of willingness, man, the stuff that started to happen, I don't know if you guys are at that spot yet. I have no idea. From what I hear, it's a pretty young community, but there was leaders in here, man. There was guys that were carrying a message. And for those of you that are here and have been here for a while, man, it's so important that you catch that newcomer when he walks in the door. You know what I mean? Because you don't want to deny somebody else that opportunity to have a solution that might save their life. And I was very fortunate that I got here at a point in time where there were some guys out here that were doing that. And they were armed with the facts about themselves. They brought me through the work just like they had been brought through it. And that's the beautiful thing about this place. It's community-based, man. It's guys helping guys. And like there was one, Chris was in here with me. Preston was in here with me. And there was this one point in time, dude, everybody was on fire. We were having book meetings even when we weren't in groups, man. We were bouncing around this place and you just see it. It was like a good atmosphere. Like I said, I'm getting excited thinking about it. I'm like, because it was just crazy what was going on, man. And I went from homeless to dying, and like I got this feeling that I can't even explain. You know, I'm bouncing around. I'm actually, you know, I was scared to help people at first. I didn't want to kill them. You know, like that was the thing that was going on at the time, and I didn't want to kill them. I was like, man, I don't want to say the wrong thing to this guy that might turn this way. Josh was actually in here for that stuff too, man. it was just badass, the stuff that was taking place. And man, I got through here and I did what they told me to do, and experience happened. You know, there was something that filled that void, man. And, you know, I give all the credit and praise to God. And I'll tell you this, the next part of my story, I've got about 30 minutes. And, you know, I didn't come in here with a vision to play baseball again. You know, I really didn't. I came in here to get rid of a drug addiction that was killing me. And I, through that process, you know, my program director at that point in time, he was like, you know, what do you want to do with your life? You know, have you given any thought? And I was, you know, he talked about baseball. My dad had apparently talked to him on the phone about baseball and how I was a good athlete. And I was thinking at this point in time, there is no possible way that I'm going to be able to go back with the damage I've done to my body. I'm right-handed, and I sported around two scars on here that were a lot worse when I walked in the door. That, you know, I've been sticking a needle in my right arm for 4 or 5 years now. There's no way I'm going to be able to go back and play the way I used to play and have that opportunity again. Well, we got some baseballs and gloves in here, and I started throwing around. I was like, man, you're throwing pretty good. You know, you got a good arm. You need to do something with this. Well, lo and behold, man, like I didn't give it any thought. It got out, and they told me I was going to ride around on a bus in South Austin, and I was going to go to this sober house. You're going to get a job. You don't get a job in 2 weeks. They kick you out. This, that, and you know. All this fear started to build up, man. You know, right before I got out, I actually asked my program director if I could stay a fourth month. You know, and me and Chris had gotten pretty close, and he wasn't getting out for 2 or 3 weeks after that. And I was like, man, I'd really like to get out with him so we could go through this thing together. And it was just, I got overwhelmed with fear, man. I started letting fear drive me, and I got away from the basic principles of this thing and giving back to other people. I got so consumed with myself from that point in time that I wasn't bouncing around the community trying to help guys, the newcomers and stuff. You know, I let fear drive me at that point in time. You know, and I blew up on somebody in Circle that day, and I was like, well, what the fuck is going on? You know, like, I'm doing everything he told me to do. You know, I'm doing my recovery. And I was like, man, I'm letting it's like the three sides of the triangle, man. If it wasn't in the hole, it wouldn't happen. You know, just that was my experience while I was in here. And so I started, you know, I got out of that as soon as I blew up one and walked out of Circle. And I remember, I think it might have been Dale or somebody. I was talking to him. I was like, man, I just need to go help somebody. You know, I just need to go sit down with somebody, get in the book. And I did that, and it was just like, it lifted me back up on my feet again, man. I was like, I'm going to be all right. You know, I'm just going to keep doing what they tell me to do. This stuff's actually working. You know, I'm doing my disciplines, and I'm staying all three sides of this triangle, and stuff's starting to happen for me. And I get out and I broke my wrist, actually, 2 weeks before we left here. Butch was there for that, man. We're playing basketball at the park, and you know, I'm in good shape. I'm the vision's back for baseball. I got all these big plans. I'm about to take on the world and save everybody, go back and play baseball. And, you know, I break my wrist. You know, I was dunking. Chris threw me a horrible alley-oop. Horrible alley-oop. And I went up and I flipped off the rim and broke my wrist. And you should have seen me that day. It looked like my dog died. You know, I was like, I was depressed. I was sitting in my bunk crying. Just like, what the hell, man? You know, I had all these big expectations when I got out, and I had to walk around with a cast for 3 months, and just miserable. And anyway, you know, through prayer and helping other people, I made my way out of that. You know, practicing the principles and doing the disciplines and helping other people, I made my way out of that. And, you know, it is what it is, man. God's trying to teach me something right here. You know, it just looks at the trials and tribulations as opportunities to grow. And got out, and I had a hard time finding a job at first, and I remember me and somebody else were sitting at the Steak and Shake eating a nasty, greasy-ass burger, and a buddy of mine, and I'll say his name, he's in Philip Hurd, called me up, and he said, man, I got this guy, I was over there, it's my financial advisor, I was just meeting with him, and you know, he said he remembered you coming out of high school, he wants you to give him a call, he's going to try and set something up for you. That one, I was like, well, I got a cast on my hand, you know, I can't do anything right now. He said, just give him a call, you know, we'll work something out. So I called him and set up a meeting with him and Justin Simmons. He's actually pitched at UT from like 2000 to 2003, I think, played in the Marlins organization. And went and met with him, and he's like looking at the cast. I was like, look, don't worry about the cast. The cast will be all right. You know, just give me an opportunity to go throw. What they were trying to do is they were trying to set me up with a bullpen at the University of Texas. You know, and I'm 2 weeks out of treatment, man, and I didn't come here to go back and play baseball. Keep that in mind. Like, this is something that just kind of a vision just felt right. It felt like the way God was pulling me. It was just, I was praying about it. I was doing Brandon meditation, and just, it felt right. And And I told him, don't worry about the cast. And I went to the doctor's office the next day. I was like, look, man, either you're going to take it off or I'm going to take it off. I got a bullpen I got to go throw with Justin, who actually had the connection with University of Texas, Skip Johnson, the pitching coach over there. And he pulled my cast off for me. He told me I'd be all right as long as I didn't, you know, lift weights, you know, trying to work it out a little bit. And me and Chris and buddy Arch Patrick, we were going to the park every day and playing catch. I was trying to get in good shape. Went through my bullpen with him. Went really well. You know, he liked what he saw. He said, let's do two or three more. That way we're on point when we go over there. That way if something comes out of this, we'll be able to do it. Well, he ended up pulling up the trigger on it. And I guess it had been about 2 months we had been out of here, something like that, 2 or 3 months. And, you know, I'm down in the University of Texas throwing the bullpen, man. It's like, what the fuck is going on? You know, how is this happening? How am I back where I used to be? Like, well, how am I able to perform the way I'm performing right now? And, you know, I mean, I was hitting every spot, had some good off-speed stuff working. They checked into my eligibility, and lo and behold, some stuff, not taking care of my stuff in high school, came back to bite me in the ass again. You know, I wasn't academically eligible to go to Division I university, so I had another decision to be made. And back in the back of my head this whole time, I'm thinking LSU units. You know, just kept clicking in my head. I owed my coach in the minutes for some stuff I'd done while I was there. And, you know, Skip was like, look, I'll set you up somewhere here in Austin or Dallas or something like that to go to a Division II school or something like that. And I was like, man, you know, I started praying, bouncing off some guys in the house. And it's like, man, I'm going to go back to LSU. So I'm going to go back and I'm going to make my amends and I'm going to try and see if I can't go back there and make some things right. So I took off. It was on a weekend. Me and Phil went down there and I met with him, and I didn't want it to look like there was an ulterior motive behind it, because there really wasn't, guys. I'm trying to clean up the records of my past at this point in time. Know this guy in amends, and as an amends to him, you know, throwing the way I was throwing, I felt like I could come back and help that team win some baseball games and perform, you know, and then be a good student, a good teammate, you know, a good player, just and all around just show them, you know, like show them I am a changed man. You know, actions speak a lot louder than words. And I went down there and I told him, I said, Coach, I got two things I need to talk to you about, man. One is, you know, I just threw a bullpen for the University of Texas and I got some opportunities coming up. And the other, I need to make some things right with you. You know, and I let him pick which one he wanted to talk about first. And he kind of told me, he's like, screw baseball, you know, what's been going on with you? And I kind of gave him the rundown. And, you know, he asked me what was different this time, man. And I was like, I got God in my life. He said, you said that last time. And, you know, through talking with him, you know, it kind of came around to let me show you. You know, let me just, there's no way I can sit here and tell you, you know, I got to show you. And he offered me to come throw a bullpen down there on that Sunday. And went and I stayed 90 to 92 miles an hour in that bullpen. And I was like, wow, you know, that's the first time anybody had actually put a gun on me since I got clean. And, pulled me and my dad and Phil up to the press box. He was talking with us. You know, he's trying to cover his basis here because there is a past here and make sure, you know, he's going to get what he's looking at. And, you know, I told him, I said, man, let me just show you what God's doing in my life. And, you know, I'll come and I'll be of service to this team and do whatever I can in whatever way and whatever role you put me in to try and help us win a national championship. And he gave me that opportunity to come back. He told me what he can give me my scholarship back. And I was blessed with people in my life that were willing to help me out at that point in time to take care of tuition and help me get through that first semester. And actually, they had all been through a fall semester, and I was starting up in the spring. I got down there, and you know, I was nervous about moving back. I stayed in my dad's house for 2 months. It was a miracle in itself. I hadn't been allowed over there in 3 years. And it was absolutely amazing what happened. I couldn't explain to you the butterflies I had on opening day, watching the flags flying. You understand this program's success and the stuff that they've been able to accomplish there. You know, it's a badass place to play. You know, put it on this level, we were to play, LSU won't schedule us because they don't want to get beat by a junior college. And we ended up in to enjoy the success I had there, man. I started off having some arm problems. You know, I stayed 88 to 92 for the first couple of weeks, first couple of outings I was there, and I was having some arm issues. You know, I just stayed in prayer and meditation, man. And I was in a position where I wasn't able to, where my service work was going to come in, being a college athlete and school. You know, I struggled with that when I first got there. I was going to have to be a service to these guys on the team, man, do whatever I can. I'll go out in the field and rake. I'll pick up trash in the dugout when I get done. I'm just going to do whatever I can to try and stay sober right now. You know, I know this is going to be a difficult process, but I use it as an opportunity to grow And through that past 6 months, man, we ended up winning the national championship. Man, I got to pitch game four in that national championship, and I ran all the way up from 90 to 96 miles an hour, man. You know, I got an opportunity to go play professional baseball next year. You know, I haven't signed with anybody yet. I have some scouts looking at me being my past and where I'm at, and they want to give it another year, make sure I stay on the course. But, like, that opportunity has been granted to me, man. And I can't sit here and take any credit for it. You know, God had everything to do with that. And you've just seen the circumstances and the people and the places and just how everything lined up. You guys are not in here together by coincidence. I figured that out, man. It was like nothing has happened here by coincidence. If you just look at it, it was like God's fingerprints are all over this thing. I did not do anything but what they told me to do, and that this opportunity has been placed in my path. You know, and little did I know while I was there, they put out an article, man. This guy came and said they're going to do an article on me because, like I said, I had a lot of success from high school being a draft pick. He told me it was just going to be in the little sports section. Well, they ended up plastering it all over the front page of the paper from Monroe all the way down to Lafayette. And I wake up the next morning, I got a text from him, had a good article, you know, he inspired us, blah, 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 and this and that. And I look on there and it's like front page of the paper, a 4-page article. I'm like, what the fuck? You know, like if you don't know, now you know kind of thing. And, the response I got from that, man, God just opened up doors that I never thought imagined. When I was here, man, I was scared to get up here and talk in front of 20 people that I've been living with for 3 months. You know, I was nervous, palms sweaty, just scared to death. And like through this process, man, and coming back and the power of God working in my life, like He opened up doors I never thought imaginable. You know, I've been able to go to high schools and speak to high schools. I've been able to go to FCA fellowships and speak there. And they've asked me to speak at the World Series next year and just, you know, the outpour of even like fan mail has come in, you know, stay the course, man, you're an inspiration to us. Just the people that are looking at me, and I just never thought I'd be in that position, man. Like actually living a life filled for Christ and the rewards that have come, the blessings, man, it's a blessing. You know, I took a lot of things for granted. You know, you wake up every morning, do you thank God for 10 fingers, 10 toes? Just because you have them don't mean you're entitled to them. You know, there's people walking around here limping around in a wheelchair, man, that would love to be in the position you're in. There's guys out there that are dying right now that would love to be sitting in these chairs that y'all are sitting in, and they don't have that opportunity. They don't have family members who ever paid for y'all to come here that they don't have the means or the way to get a message like y'all are getting here. You know, and that's one thing I was blessed, and my dad was willing to take that one last shot with me. And I think it was harder to convince him of the program than it was myself at that point in time. But I did what I was supposed to do. I did what the book told me to do, man. And I stuck to the book. You know, I didn't stray off. Like, I was out of ideas at that point in time. You know, and there was that one thing I was convinced of, and that was that first step. You know, no growth can come from the first step. It all was around that, man. I got a thorough ass whipping, and I ran out of ideas, and I was willing to believe in a power greater than myself at that point in time. And it just... just from 4 through 9 on, like the conscience of my belief came to me and stuff started to happen that I just couldn't even wrap my mind around. And I didn't really care at the time how it was happening. I was just going to keep doing what I was doing because that was what was working. And the blessing that's poured out from that has been unbelievable. You know, to be back playing baseball, living a dream, and actually be placed in a position where I can be of service to hundreds of people right now, it blows me away, man. And have the opportunity to... the book's still being written, you know, and this thing's about humility and being humble. And, you know, I come in here and I'm just trying to give you a testimony of the power of God working in my life, man. That's all I'm trying to do. That maybe somebody in here will maybe look into my eyes and see that God is real, man. He's real and He's working in each and every one of your lives, whether you like it or not, you know. And all you got to do is right there. The power is deep down within you. You know, so that's a great reality of great reality is He's found deep down within each and every one of us. And like, I finally got that, man. You know, God gave me this power. You know, I'm just going to use it. You know, I don't like the way I'm living, so I'm going to change it. You know, I'm going to do these things. He's not going to do for me what I can't do for myself. What I can do for myself. But He will do for me what I can't if I'm following His path and serving other people, man. You know, not praying for my own selfish ends anymore. And you know, going out and packing stuff into the stream of life, man. Because you get out of the universe, you put back in. You know, when I was putting bad stuff out there and we started doing these I am. Do y'all still do I am statements? I had 20. I've got the 17 on that list already, checked off. It's unreal. I started putting good stuff out in the universe and I started getting good stuff back. It doesn't always look like that, but I can tell you 95 to 90% of the time it does. When I was putting bad stuff out there and we did that little worksheet and I saw saw my thoughts, and man, I was creating my own reality in a sense, and it just, you know, it blew me away. And then finally, like, the starting to slowly unfold, man. Starting to slowly unfold in front of me, and I'm just on the very, I'm a year and 5 months sober, and four months sober, and I actually got out of rehab a year ago, 3 days. So, you know, to be sitting where I am today, you know, a year and 4 months, 5 months into this thing is just, you know, it's a testimony of the power of God. That's really all I can say, man. I had absolutely nothing to do with it. I did a little work, and He took care of the rest. And life is just taking on a whole new vision. You know, to be able to see the world and operate in it with an awakened spirit today just blows me away, man. You know, we were actually flying in the plane the other day, and we're cutting through the clouds, and it was just, I was riding a cockpit, and it was just, you know, I got to see the beautiful universe, man, from a different perspective up there. It was like, look at all this stuff. You know, and every time, like, you'll have these moments in sobriety, man, where things aren't going good, and you'll start to drift away a little bit, man, and God just pulls me right back, you know. I get on fire for this thing again. You know, I love coming here and speaking to you guys, dude. This is where I found God, you know, and I'm forever in debt to this place. And I just, you know, I pray for each and every one of y'all every night. You know, I don't know you, but I know you real well. You know, I'm just like you. Deep down, we all got here with the same stories. You know, I'm not trying to impress anybody with mine. It's just, you know, we're all trying to beat an illness, man, that's killing us. And there's a common solution to it, man. And if you go out there and carry that message in the book that y'all are learning here, man, the sky's the limit. Stuff's going to start to take off for you. And I'm not going to paint it like it's a bed of roses. Your story might not look like my story, man, but I promise you things are going to start to happen in your life that you're not going to be able to explain. You know, I promise we're going to be launching a level of existence best and the best we've ever known. And that's been my experience. It really has. And I know probably 8 or 9 guys that I went through here with that are still sober. You know, a lot of them didn't make it. I've had a lot of guys die, and you know, I had a lot of friends die when I was out there using, you know, suicides, murders, you know, stuff I actually saw, you know, in person. And it was, you ask yourself, why did I get to make it and these other people had to die, man? And sometimes people have to carry a message of death. But like, my purpose was to carry a message of hope to somebody. And God's laid that path out in front of me, and I'm very blessed that I'm able to stand up here in front of you guys today and give that testimony. You know, I didn't ask for this story. I didn't come to rehab to come back and talk to you. I never thought in a million years I'd be standing back in the same podium I was a year ago and sharing a message with a new group of guys in here. You know, I was scared to death to tell it when I was in here. And it's just, like I said, man, the sky's the limit. It's all up to you. If you're done, you're convinced of that first step, you do what they tell you to do, you're going to be all right, man. You're going to be all right, and I promise you that. You know, they said that the success rate, I think it says in the foreword of the second edition, of 50% that first came in here and actually did it stayed sober. The other 25% had to go out and get some more and came back. So that's pretty much 75% success rate of the message that's carried in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, not the water down middle of the road stuff. And the other 25 showed improvement through the program and stayed with it. So guys, I mean, there's people out there. You just got to see it. You know, you got to find that guy that's armed with the facts about themselves. And that's why I talk about the leadership in here. And, you know, it's so important to carry that message, man. You know, try and help that new cat that's coming in here that's dying and needs a solution, needs a way out. You know, I was very fortunate that I had that when I got here and my ears were open enough and the shit had been beaten out of me enough to be able to listen to it. And that's really the only reason I got where I am today. You know, and I like to open it up if y'all have any questions for me or anything like that. That's really, I'm not going to take up too much more of y'all time. I know y'all probably hungry and during y'all's free time and stuff. I don't want y'all to get any concerns or anything. But if anybody had any questions whatsoever, I'd be more than happy to answer them. If not, then yeah, buddy.
What's the longest time you had in sobriety other than the last year?
2 weeks. Well, the 45 days that I was actually in that treatment center, and then I stayed 2 weeks sober. But that's how it looks every time, man. When I didn't have a solution to that spiritual malady, it was kicking my ass, man. I didn't even know what it was. And I got in here and, like, I actually started to read this book, and I started relating my experiences with the experiences in the book. And I was like, all right, dude, you know, like, what the fuck? I've been reading this for 6 years now, in and out of the program, and like, it's never looked like this to me. Like, it's always looked like Shakespeare, you know, or some. I couldn't comprehend what was going on, but I had guys that were walking me through it, and like, you know, relate this to your experience, man. What does it look like for you? And I was like, well, damn, I'm a dope fiend, you know, I'm an alcoholic. There's nothing I can do about it. And I didn't know what hopeless looked like until I got here and went through those first, the doctor's been through the first 42, 43 pages. And I was like, what hopeless looked like is no matter what I do, I'm going to shoot dope again. And that was the message that I got out of my first step. No matter what I do, I'm going to shoot dope again. Well, fuck. And then it offers you a way out. There is a solution. Followed through with the program, man. And I found a solution that had some depth and weight to save my life. You know, and I always had a hard time wrapping my mind around, we don't have a choice whether we drink or drug again. And I went back and I could relate thousands of experiences where, guys, I didn't have a choice whether I drank or drug, man. I knew I had responsibilities. I had my last $50, man. And I didn't have gas for the week, food for the week, or a roof over my head. And I told myself thousands of times I was going to, you know, this money, this paycheck was going to what it needed to go to. And I'm driving. I know I need to turn off at the last red light, but I keep going for some reason. And I don't want to. I didn't have a choice. You know, I started to see those things. And it just took off. You know, I just can't express to you what God has done in my life, man. Just from being willing to accept the program and actually go through and work it wholeheartedly and to the best of my ability, man. Because it wasn't complicated. It really wasn't. I tried to make it complicated. Anybody else?
You said that about a month and a half in here, you had an experience that changed the way that you looked at stuff. Like, what did that experience look like?
It looked like me on the... It was when I quit putting expectations on these steps, man. It happened about my fifth, six, and seven. I was out here on this back porch meditating, and like, man, just that, it wasn't a burning bush experience. It didn't look anything like that, man. It was just a clear thought that came in my head that, you know, this thing is not that complicated, Kirk. It's not, you know, it's not easy. But it's not complicated as I'm trying to make it. And I didn't get any burning bush experiences whatsoever. Life did not look like I wanted it to look when I got out of here and while I was in here. Nothing has looked the way I imagined it looking. It's looked better. You know what I mean? And in a good way. Like, stuff has gone south for me. But like, I see the reason behind it now. And that's where the faith came in. I started with a belief and it turned into faith in that belief. You know what I mean? Like, I know God's got my back today. And that's kind of the clarity spot that I was at that point in time, where that was what my experience looked like. And other guys saw it. Me and Chris were talking about this earlier. Other guys saw it before I saw it. You know what I mean? Like, I started that change, man, and I was looking for it so hard that I missed it. And it was starting to happen without me even knowing. Like I said, it talks about in the ninth step promises, where the problem's gone. You know, that's a miracle of it. And that was what happened with me, man. Like, I just started thinking. I was like, man, drugs and alcohol aren't what I'm dealing with anymore. I'm sitting here trying to learn how to live. I'm like every other normal person in this universe right now, except I have a physical allergy to drugs and alcohol. And I don't know how to stop once I start. You know, so yeah, obviously, taking that first drink, I gotta find a way to stay away from it. You know, and then through the program and solution I got here, I was able to do that, man. And this is a chronic progressive illness. I am no farther away from a drinking drug today than I was a year and 4 months ago, man. And that's what keeps me on fire to keep doing the things I need to do to stay sober. And I've been blessed. There's been a lot of opportunities opened up for me outside of AA, you know, to be of service, like going and speaking at these high schools. And then, you know, I could book from now till December, man. I mean, there's a story to be told, and it'd be selfish of me not to tell it. You know, and like I said, the book's still being written. You know, I hope next year, June 4th, June 5th, I'll be able to sign a professional baseball contract, you know. And it's just, it blows me away how I am where I am today, man. You know, words can't describe it. I can't wrap my mind around it at all, and I don't have to today, and that's the beautiful part about it. You know, God either is or He isn't, right? You know, that's really, really what I went with, you know. He's got my back. You know, I know there's going to be trials and tribulations, but it's His opportunities to grow, you know. And the same character defects I had on my fourth step when I was in here are the same exact character defects I have when I do enemy inventory now that I'm sober. It's the same exact ones, man, but I'm aware of it today. I'm aware of it. And in six and seven, like, you offer them to God, but what are you going to do about it? you know, you're sitting there gossiping about somebody, but, you know, gossip is on your character defect list or dishonesty, and you know you're lying, and you're just going to jump right into it anyway. You know, that I catch myself doing that shit all the time, man. All the time, but I'm aware of it, and I'm willing to grow. Spiritual principles are enough to keep me busy the rest of my life. They're enough to keep me sober the rest of my life, as long as I'm willing to grow. You know, and the minute I put material growth before spiritual growth, I'm back to where I'm back with a needle in my arm, man. And I just was very blessed that I'd gone out and tried everything I possibly could. It says, where is it at? We agnostics, I think. You know, it says circumstances get us willing. You know, and that's what it looked like. I mean, man, I had a bunch of circumstances and stuff that were stacked on top of me. I was trying to get out of a bad situation I was in, man. I got in here, and circumstances got me willing. They don't keep me sober, but it got me willing. So no matter what got you in here, your parents threw you in here. You know, you came in here unwillingly, willing in court system, whatever it was, man. Look at it as a circumstance. That's all it is, you know. And what are you going to do from here with your life? Because if you don't like the way you're living, change it. God has given you that power. It's deep down within you. All you got to do is unblock yourself from it, gain access to it, go out there and carry it to somebody else. You know, the only thing that separates me from a normal person is a physical allergy. You know, it's everyday life. We like to shoot dope and then drink alcohol or snort pills or whatever we do to fix our problems. You know, and that's not any way to live, man. That shit's going to kill me. And if it doesn't kill me physically, it's going to be even worse. And I think my disease still has a lot more ass kicking it can do. You know what I mean? It can still bring me to deeper and darker places than I've ever been. Now that I've seen it, you know. I went back out and it did. It drove me back down. You know, and some people have to get that experience. Some people have to go out and get some more. And it's part of it, man. You know, but relapse doesn't have to be a part of your story. You know, it really doesn't. You come in here and you do what you need to do, man. And carry a message to somebody else. When it goes through there and ask you to do something in the big book, do it. It's an experience. Guaranteed. You know, it's a promise. Well, I'm going to go ahead and end here, man. I really appreciate y'all giving me the opportunity.